Hello, this is the takeaway for Monday, January 23rd, 2017. Oh, and by the way, go Falcons.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm coming to you from KOSU in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. This community, this city, opened itself to us on the very first Monday of the Trump presidency. And what a weekend of contrasts and collages of American democracy, political passion we saw, maybe some confusion. Marches around the world raised issues of gender and the protection of marginalized communities in an unmistakable way. The Women's March is being called the largest political demonstration in U.S. history. New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, even here in red state Oklahoma, the numbers exceeded all expectations. And here's what I mean about contrasts. At one point, there were aerial shots from cities around the world, and at the exact same moment, over at the CIA, Donald Trump was trying to mend fences with his national security team on Saturday, while Kellyanne Conway was arguing on behalf of alternative facts. There was a debate over crowd sizes at his inauguration, a blasting of the media, and it was all the opening chord of this Trump-era symphony, set amidst very real actions taken by the Trump administration, executive orders rolling back the Affordable Care Act, annual mortgage insurance premiums borrowers pay when taking out government-backed loans were frozen. The Justice Department cleared the way for President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to formally join the team. Distance from the White House and overwhelming solidarity in the streets for a democracy that is more representative of the people. That's what we saw over the weekend. But in this possibly more pro-Trump state than any other in the union, all that was very far away. Just outside of Oklahoma City, in a howling, constant wind on a hill in a little town called Wellston, a big farmhouse with sturdy planks, land stretching for miles, with a chicken coop here and there, a tool barn over there, a line of more than a half dozen brand new but dusty pickup trucks lined the driveway. And here at the home of plumbing contractor Wayne McConnell, pickups trump Priuses. But it's surprising as you sip a cup of coffee and gather around the couch with a big screen TV tuned to the Green Bay Packers' demise, the sound turned down, of course, there is some serious skepticism about Donald Trump, perhaps the biggest conservative change agent in American politics in two generations. Big Wayne says Donald Trump's got a style problem.
I think he's too bombastic. I think he goes overboard, but I think it appeals to a lot of people. And in some ways, it appeals to me.
Meet Dwayne Danker, family friend and superintendent of the Wellston Public Schools. He's not impressed with Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos.
I don't like the road that we're on as far as his choice for Secretary of Education.
And there's young Meg Stewart, Wayne's daughter. She's a college graduate, a stay-at-home mom, and likes Donald Trump taking on the media, but is worried that he might be getting in his own way.
You can appreciate what he's trying to do as far as letting more people be heard and making it to where the media doesn't have as much control. But yes, I think you can recognize that there are flaws in what he's trying to and how he's trying to accomplish it.
And then there's Tracy Swofford, a teacher at Wellston Public Schools who speaks for all these folks on a Sunday afternoon. After 8 years of Obama, it's time for the pendulum to swing.
I feel like our whole country's too far to the left. The moral standards, what you see on TV, I don't feel is representative of what most of America feels, or the map wouldn't look like it does.
And that was our mission, to spend some time with people who feel forgotten by the elites of Washington, who want change, who understand that while they may be in a bubble, so are the people in power, and they are determined to be heard. So far, they're pretty happy with what they see. Will McConnell is Wayne's son, a pastor, father of 9 kids, 3 adopted, and he's also a plumber in Oklahoma City.
I didn't vote for Trump. In the primaries, I voted for Dr. Carson. And in the presidency, I actually didn't vote for either president candidate because I don't like the idea of voting against somebody, which is what a lot of conservatives did. They're not for Trump. They were just against Hillary. And I don't like that premise. I personally am not a huge advocate for President Trump. I hope he's going to move the country in the direction, at least that I hope the country's going to move into, which is more of a conservative, more of kind of a power to the people.
But you're not afraid of Trump being president?
No, because I think the president doesn't have a lot of power in the first place. One, I'm a Christian, and so I have complete confidence in God having control of everything. And if Hillary was president, I'd have confidence that she was there for a reason also. And so I don't have a fear that Trump's president, I think he can be a little authoritarian, a little dictatorship type style. And so I'm cautious of that. But it seems to be the type of people he is surrounding himself with are people that I would like to see more of our country move towards that way.
What's your message to people who believe, you know, bans on Muslims, expressions of racially incorrect kinds of statements that seem to endorse racial intolerance, and even the, you know, making fun of the reporter with the disability? What's your message to people who focus a lot on that?
It's unacceptable. I mean, it needs to stop. I mean, it's not right, and it needs to stop. Pretty well it in a nutshell. We need to all be treated equal, but, I mean, Oklahoma's strongly pro-life, most of us. And Trump was pro-life, and, you know, Hillary was not. So, I mean, you look at some of those type of issues, and that's, you know, like I said, you might not agree with a lot of things on Trump, but there's some things that we value even more.
Is liberal immoral?
No. Not in and of itself, no. But when you made a comment to Dwayne about banning Muslims, they didn't what he said. Trump never, and I didn't vote for Trump either. Don't get me wrong. I didn't vote for either one of the two. When you're talking about is liberalism bad or good, no, it's not in and of itself any more than conservatives by itself is good or bad.
To try to decode that, it sounds like the parties don't have a whole lot of meaning to any of you folks here.
I would say it's what they stand for more than if they call themselves Democrat or Republican. Do they say they're pro-life? They say they're pro-American. Do they say they're for putting people to work and not everybody just wanting to live off everybody else? I mean, it's time people are responsible for themselves and their families and go to work. And I mean, I do feel like that Republican is just a name, Democrat's name. I'm going to vote for who I feel like I line up more with what they say they believe in, because that's all we have to go off of is what they say they believe in.
Do you think we've reached a point in American history where we need to do something maybe a little more intentional about getting together blacks and whites somehow, and that whatever we're doing right now isn't working?
I would agree that whatever we're doing right now is not working. Gosh, yeah, there's policemen out there, I'm sure, that have made mistakes. We've watched it on TV where it looks like they probably shouldn't have fired a gun, but sometimes they just got a second to make a decision, you know, whether they think somebody's got a gun or a weapon, and could have been an honest mistake many times, but just say they were shot because of their color, I don't know that happens very, very rarely.
There came to be, in the last few years of the Obama administration, a consensus among conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats that the number of people who are incarcerated was too much, and there needed to be some kind of sentencing reform, that there needs to be some program for releasing people who are sentenced and in a situation where when they come out, they are ill-equipped to deal with society and are much more likely to create the kinds of problems that you were talking about over here. Are you aware of that consensus that Republicans and Democrats want to try to come together and change that?
They've been saying that for 100 years. The recidivism rate whenever they get out of prison has always been sky high. But go back to the baser, and that is, if you lack the morals, then you're going to break the law. You break the law, you're more likely to go to prison. Most of the people, black, white, red, any other color, that are in prison are there because of a bad moral decision.
There are folks who say that the cumulative effect of slavery and then what happened during Jim Crow, where people were lynched in public, and the violence that took place against African Americans has produced a series of kind of moral and spiritual scars, and also a lack of opportunity that we're just now getting to deal with. Is there anything that we need to do now to compensate for that history?
No. I'm a card-carrying Indian, okay? So my ancestors were on the Trail of Tears with the Cherokee tribe. I'm also Irish, and the Irish were getting whooped up on by the English for hundreds of years. I don't have those scars. I grew up. And when I grew up, I took responsibility for myself. I didn't blame what happened to my grandfather three generations back. That's the kind of the way I look at it.
When you say that, it means like we're stuck, because if you're gonna say that and they're gonna believe that there are real problems, then we're never gonna agree, and there're gonna be lots of people in prison, and the crime's just gonna stay the same.
It may stay the same, but that's the price that they'll have to pay.
Who's hopeful and why?
Well, I'm hopeful. I try to be optimistic, and I think there's gonna be some changes made.
Hopeful because it's a new day, because of the heart and the propensity for the American people to restore and to heal. Hopeful because it has seemed to me over the past 8 years that our commander and chief, kind of the leader, representative leader of our country, hasn't helped to heal racial divides. I'm hopeful that for a man who has been in the entertainment industry and the business industry for most of his life, and who has worked with a variety of different people from different ethnicities, that he will use those skills to be able to try to mend.
Sometimes I'm very hopeful because I'll see, especially in social media, where people, it seems like they're looking for answers more than just accepting what's handed to them. And I'm hopeful for that because then I hope that it helps them become more involved and more engaged, not only in politics, but in their community. But then again, I'm more anxious than anything just to see how it goes.
I think there's a lot more in common with the average American than we ever give realize, because the media and others focus on small, very small events that people extrapolate to get a distorted view of everybody, and it gives you a false perspective.
I'm hopeful about the programs that he says, the agenda that he says he's going to do. I'm hopeful because I don't put my faith in any man. I put mine in my Lord. And so who wins or loses in the end, of course, I would be very sad if Hillary Clinton had won, but my hope would not be lost.
That's Tracy Swafford, a teacher at Wellston Public Schools. We also spoke with Wayne McConnell and his son Will, both plumbers in Oklahoma City. Meg Stewart, Wayne's daughter, is a college graduate and a stay-at-home mother. And we met Dwayne Danker, the superintendent of Wellston Public Schools. They gave of their time generously on a Sunday afternoon, and we learned a lot. Over the weekend, we all witnessed an unprecedented outpouring of democracy, political passion, and the solidarity of women determined to be heard.
We are the people!
We are the people!
Mighty, mighty people!
Mighty, mighty people!
We want justice!
We want justice!
And liberation!
And liberation!
We've seen through the course of history, nothing is done when you sit back and be silent, so I think this is just the great opportunity to take this time and say that we have voices and we're not happy with how things are going.
And we're here to empower all people, women.
The ability to control your body and control your life is the most basic definition of freedom that I can think of.
All right, so the idea of the Women's March was unity and standing together.
We, all of us together as one.
It's always positive to see people come together and doing the right thing. And if we continue to do it over and over again in our everyday lives, it'll definitely make a difference.
So my sign says, I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I am changing the things that I cannot accept.
I'm a supporter of love, and I pray that Trump has a successful presidency for all of us.
They feel like they're doing something, and when they click like on a post on Facebook and it does nothing. So I think people are seeing that they really need to do more than that.
They're welcome to come back here again next month, the month after, because this is just the first step.
That's why we keep coming, and that's why we keep trying to do stuff to open up people's eyes.
Well, I hope we send a message to the White House that we are power in numbers. We are great in numbers, and they need to listen to what we have to say.
You know, burn the bra, all that kind of stuff. And now we're back doing the same thing, right? I did it in my 20s, now I'm doing it in my 60s.
Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God, that we may all be one. And that's just my hope, that we may all be one and move in a positive direction.
People sticking together, sticking up for one another, just in a bigger way. Like, and if you go from the smaller places, it'll make a big difference. It could spread to the country, the continent, and even the world.
Everywhere we go!
Everywhere!
estimated 470,000 people attended Saturday's Women's March on Washington, exceeding the initial 200,000 estimate. Across the nation, from D.C. to Chicago and L.A., sister marches brought out over 1 million protesters. Even here in Oklahoma City, there was a march. The few marchers early on assumed it would be a lonely day with maybe some heckling to deal with. But no, it couldn't have been more different.
Towards the end, before we started marching, someone got up and stood up and said, "We have 12,000 people here." And all of the individuals on stage, just tears were in their eyes.
That's a very surprised Ellen Pogue-Miller, who attended the Oklahoma City March with her mother and aunt.
I think everyone was overwhelmed by the amount of support and the amount of people that cared and the amount of people that wanted to be heard.
What does that say about this community and about what people think as perhaps the stereotype of this community?
I mean, I think Oklahoma is known as a red state, so people anticipated low numbers or maybe people who were disengaged or people who supported some of the rhetoric that was being said at the national level. And I think what we were there to say is that we are a red state and we hear that rhetoric. We hear people who are not inclusive, people who don't want to invest in education, who aren't willing to invest in healthcare. And we don't want that to move to a national stage. And so we're here as Oklahomans who understand that we need to invest in our communities and we want to do it at the local, state, and federal level.
Are there bubbles here that are equal to the bubbles in New York and L.A. and Chicago?
I think it's critical to get outside of your bubbles. And I think we're all guilty of it. The neighborhood I live in probably voted more on a Democratic leaning than the majority of the state. The whole state of Oklahoma went to Trump. So we were as red as you can
overwhelmingly.
Get. Overwhelmingly. Yeah. But we do find pockets, and we're all guilty of kind of isolating ourselves within those communities. In Oklahoma, our divide really does come down a lot of times to a rural and urban divide, and that actually can cross red and blue. I mean, you can have a rural legislator who's in a blue district but votes with other rural legislators because the issues in rural Oklahoma are different than the issues in urban Oklahoma City and Tulsa. I grew up in a rural town in Paris, Texas. We're about 25,000, and we're right on the Oklahoma border. And so I generally understand where kind of the mentality of a rural community fits in. The schools and the neighborhoods and the industry in some of those communities, they've lost a ton in those communities. And you drive through in that main street, there's one or two stores or one restaurant, and it is heartbreaking. And you want those communities to have something to increase their populations.
What's the biggest concern for you and your family?
I focus really kind of three main issues for us. Climate change is a big issue, education and healthcare. Science is incredibly important to my family. And we worry sometimes that the individuals at our state and at our federal level aren't looking at science with an open mind.
Do you think the 12,000 that showed up in Oklahoma City could wave back at Gloria Steinem on the stage in Washington and say, "Hey, we're here too"?
Yeah, that would be we're here. We are excited. We want change too, and we're speaking the same language. And there's so many issues that could be more bipartisan. And I feel like the rhetoric sometimes, it's either you're with us or against us. And I think it's important that we are more inclusive. There were 12,000 people there that had signs that were from issues at the state, local, and federal level, issues about immigration, issues about healthcare, about issues about climate change and science, and all of these different issues that even some of the signs you may not agree with their policy, but people wanted to be heard. And people at the march, the biggest takeaway was like, don't let this be your last step. Stay engaged with the community and make sure that you are a voice and that you're speaking up. We can't be silenced.
Oklahoma City resident Ellen Pogue-Miller works for a local nonprofit and attended the Oklahoma City March on Saturday.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI.
Unprecedented drama, maybe some expected confusion in this transition, and possibly some repudiation of the long-held traditions of Washington and the presidency. That characterizes the first weekend of the Trump era, filled with more drama than a new president might have wanted, especially in light of the huge marches that took place around the country and the high disapproval ratings for this incoming president. Martha Kumar is the director of the White House Transition Project. She's the author of the book Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed a Transfer of Power. Martha, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. It's nice to be with you.
Can I just get a sense from you, storms are like Category 5, Category 4, Category 3, in terms of the kinds of changes that are envisioned by this president, is this a Category 5 or is this something that is well within precedent in your historical memory?
Well, he's talked about a great change, but he has not really specified what that change is. Reagan, when he came in, talked about change as well. President Reagan wanted to eliminate two departments, energy and education. And when he left, not only were those departments still there, but Veterans Affairs, he added. In George W. Bush's administration, when he came in, he had laid out, even though his transition was not a 73-day, but rather a 37-day one, during that time, he laid out what his priorities were going to be. And he came in, the first week was education week. Second week was faith-based. Third week, military buildup. Then he did tax reform and budget cuts. When you're coming in, if you're going to lay out change, you have to do it in a very organized fashion. And I think we can see here the difficulty of getting going when over the weekend they were playing defense and spending time not on policy, not on their agenda, but griping about the news media. And reality is every president feels that he's a victim of the press. And that's just something that you have to get over.
Let me ask you about the idea that without a coherent plan and with a lot of people guessing, some have described that he, just in terms of his style, has already changed the presidency, that he's a sort of Jacksonian figure coming into the White House. Does that lack of a plan represent a kind of power over the agencies because they keeps them guessing, and that at least in the short term, he has a certain kind of leverage that no other president has really even tried to use?
I think we'll have to see how that's going to work out. I think it's difficult to move government, and you have to have a plan. You have to have the backing of Congress, and there he has Republican control. And then you have to have the personnel. At this point, they have the cabinet secretaries all selected, and they did that early, but they don't have the deputies lined up. At least they haven't released them. And so that is going to be important as well. And then getting those people in there. So it takes a while to stand up the government because you want about 400 people in by the August recess of Congress, confirmed and in their jobs, because career people are not going to be able to move the departments in the same way that a political team will.
I'm thinking about the style and the transition of Ronald Reagan when he came in 1980. I can imagine that if there were the scale of demonstrations the day after his inauguration that we saw over the weekend with the women's marches around the nation and the world, that Reagan would have made an attempt to absorb that Democratic outpouring as something he was responsible for. He would have said, wow, what a great country. Those are my people. I hear you. And even if he wouldn't have been agreeing with everything that he saw, he would have made an overture that would have, in a sense, absorbed the sense of political conflict. Trump has not done that. Do you have any advice for what you would do in a situation like we saw over this weekend, which was unprecedented?
I think that Reagan always looked at things as sunny side up. And one of the things that he was able to do was balance things in such a way he could talk about change, but then give people who were in government and surrounding government some sense of confidence in his willingness to bring them in. So, for example, after the election and after he had taken a short vacation, he came to Washington and he gave a party at the F Street Club. And the guests for that party were the leadership of Congress, not just bringing together Republicans, talking to Republicans, but he brought in the Democrats on the Hill and the committee chairs and minority heads of committees. But he also brought in operatives in Washington, people like Robert Strauss, a well-known Democrat, Lloyd Cutler, also a Democratic lawyer, and people that he knew were important to make Washington work, and let them know that he needed everybody to be working along with his administration. He didn't see himself just as a Republican president, but rather he was making that switch from being a candidate to being president of the United States, president of all the people. And that is a change that President Trump needs to bring about, because he has spoken about the campaign and in campaign mode all the way through the transition. And he needs to make that switch.
How much sympathy did you have? I know you spent a bunch of time attempting to deal with what appeared to be serious discrepancies about, you know, crowd sizes, et cetera, in that CIA speech. And then, of course, popping up the alternative facts phrase that I believe Ms. Conway used at a certain point.
Yes, yesterday.
You know, they've got a job if he's going to continue doing this.
I thought it was just a real waste of time. What you want to do is come into the briefing room and talk about the president's program. These early days are important because the public is watching and the public is listening. And later they're going to tune out. But you have the goodwill for a president in those early days. And you want to make use of it to start your program off, to explain to people what it is that you want to do. What are your priorities? What are those programs? And you don't want to waste your time talking about crowd size.
Nothing's more precious than having the attention of the American people. That's the takeaway from Martha Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project. She's author of the book Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed a Transfer of Power. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Martha, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This story is a reminder that the accepted science of one era can radically change. Our partners at Retro Report take us back to a time when pesticides were once thought of as miracle chemicals. Chief among them, the insecticide DDT, discovered in the 1930s.
This diabolical weapon of modern science saved millions of humans, but killed billions of insects. Man, with this newly discovered force, has at long last gained the upper hand in our age-old struggle.
Swiss scientist Paul Hermann Müller was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine for discovering DDT. But by 1962, marine biologist Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, warning of the harmful effects of pesticides like DDT, calling for a more holistic approach in controlling insect populations. Carson's warnings were panned by some scientists and the media. Time magazine wrote that Carson's book was an emotional and inaccurate outburst, but she had created a revolution in the way we deal with environmental pests. The partners at Retro Report, in a co-production with American Experience, discovered Carson's approach makes more environmental sense today, especially in the battle against the Zika virus. Kit Rohn and Sarah Weiser are producers for Retro Report.
She was attacking a product, a pesticide, that was revered. People thought of DDT as important as the atomic bomb in ending World War II. It saved countless soldiers' lives. Science and technology at that point were seen as doing no wrong. We were embarking on a new glorious future.
And what was the warning? I mean, what specifically was the warning from Rachel Carson?
Her warning was basically that we were overusing chemicals, spraying them without any regard to the environment, and not being judicious enough in how we're using them.
And what were the impacts? I mean, what was ultimately going to be the implication of that?
Her concern was the effect on the environment and how the DDT and other pesticides could travel up the food chain and affect various levels of organisms and possibly people.
How much of a headwind was she fighting when she made this argument? Because this was something that was perceived as a miracle chemical.
It was the most publicized and probably the most used pesticide in the world. But it was put in paint that you paint on your house. People were sprayed daily in the South in the summers. Everyone thought that it was saving lives. So to say that possibly it was killing animals or harming humans was quite a big deal. And the pesticide companies fought very vigorously to discredit her, calling her hysterical, mentioning that she is a woman, and really tried to silence her.
The major claims in Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts. If man were to faithfully follow the teachings of Miss Carson, we would return to the Dark Ages.
So a woman making this argument was really going up against a very established male scientific, institution.
Yeah, I think it was a big deal that she was a woman, kind of questioning the authority of scientists who were mostly at that time many men. You know, you had Time magazine and people coming out and saying that, this was a hysterical outburst and criticism like that.
How were her theories and her warnings vindicated by test results in the environment?
One of the things that they found early on was that this was a persistent toxin and that it built up in, it was a mother's milk stored in the fat, that it remained in people and in animals could be decades.
Fast forward to the end of the century, and all of a sudden this persistent diminished use of pesticides appears to have the impact of, oh my gosh, malaria is rising, the effect of insects, and of course the population is rising, and the idea of these sorts of diseases is once again perceived as a scourge. How does that present itself?
The continuing prevalence of malaria and the rise of malaria that sort of coincided with the publication of Silent Spring has been latched on by critics, basically saying that this sort of correlation is causation. Where they're wrong is that the rise in malaria was already occurring prior to the publication of Silent Spring because of some of the very issues that Rachel Carson brought up in Silent Spring, which is that if you overuse a pesticide, the insects become resistant to it.
What's the wisdom now that we have as we look at the claims of Rachel Carson and see what we know now about science and attempt to attack some of these diseases, which are very much a problem in the modern world?
I think a big lesson has been the need for a variety of approaches and that there's really no silver bullet in fighting malaria or anything else. And you really need to take in all these different ideas and different approaches in order to find the solution that works. There is a place for pesticides. There's also a place for every other sort of tool that can come in and make a difference.
Kit Roan and Sarah Weisers are producers for Retro Report. You can see their documentary at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. A historic regime change full of uncertainty in West Africa. After 22 years in power, Gambian President Yahya Jammeh fled into exile over the weekend after finally admitting defeat by challenger Adama Barrow in the country's most recent election. He once proclaimed he would rule for a billion years and defied the international community and his own military since the beginning of December. But he's finally gone. Dion Searcy is the West Africa Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Dakar, Senegal. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
Does this settle things down in Gambia? What's the feeling like right now?
I think in Gambia right now, there's a lot of euphoria, over the fact that for Barrow supporters that Jammeh is gone. But there's a lot of uncertainty right now. I mean, this is a country without a president. I mean, the president is just a few miles from my house here in Dakar. He hasn't been able to return home because apparently the situation isn't secure. It hasn't been deemed secure by the international forces that are in there right now.
Does this count as a peaceful transfer of power, even though there was an election, and given the fact that there are forces inside Gambia trying to preserve order?
Certainly. I mean, and there were no shots fired. No one died. There wasn't violence. President Jammeh left of his own accord. He was certainly persuaded to leave by the Ghanaian president and, a cadre of international leaders who had been flying in to try to get him to go. And yes, I think the presence of foreign troops certainly may have helped, but he had pledged to defend the country. The threat of violence sent tens of thousands of people scurrying across the border, you know, fearing for their lives that this would be a bloody outcome. And, you know, nothing like that happened. So it was quite peaceful.
In terms of trade and the economy, what was interrupted in this period of time, if anything? And how quickly will things get back to normal, economically speaking?
Well, a lot of shops were shut down. I mean, the streets were a ghost town while things worked out. But I think already things are starting to come back open. I mean, Gambia has had a really pretty rough economy. I mean, the last 22 years under President Jammeh's rule have been difficult for a lot of people. He threw a lot of people in jail who opposed him. He carried out some pretty erratic witch hunts, literal witch hunts, said he could cure AIDS with herbs and a banana and a prayer. I mean, this is a guy who hasn't kept the country really, you know, running economically so well. I mean, thousands of people have fled to Europe to find jobs. And so President Barrow says that is his chief priority right now, is getting the economy back on track, but he has no specifics.
And what would be the orderly transfer of power? The president comes back, and then is there anything that has to happen in the parliament itself? And what does this say about the quality and the power of regional authorities to intervene without causing bloodshed?
It's definitely a peculiar situation. And for the transfer of power, I mean, the guy just has to get there. You know, he's going to fly in. He told me yesterday, I interviewed him in his living room in his house here in Senegal. He's going to take a plane there, and he's appointing his cabinet today and just get down to business. The holdup is a little surprising. I think we're going on day 5, where he has been president and hasn't been home yet. So apparently, you know, I think they want to make sure that the military forces are really going to be loyal to him. He'll be back as soon as he can be, I'm sure.
So a weary uncertainty with some optimism in your voice there, Dion Searcy, West Africa Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks for speaking to us from Dakar.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com.
In the southeast region of the country, severe thunderstorms and tornadoes have swept through the states of Georgia and Mississippi, wreaking devastation, destroying homes. So far, authorities have confirmed at least 18 people killed, dozens more injured. According to Georgia's Emergency Management Agency, the storm had up to 20 reports of tornadoes within it. Governors in both Georgia and Mississippi have declared states of emergency. Joining us now is Bill Bunting from Norman, Oklahoma. He's the chief of forecast operations for the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center. Welcome to The Takeaway, Bill.
Hello, and great to be with you today.
So you're in Norman. I mean, this part of the country is more associated with Tornado Alley, but the southeast is getting an unusual spate of unusual severity storms. Can you explain what's going on and how unusual it is?
Sure. Well, while this is unusual, it's not unprecedented. Unfortunately, this time of the year, when we do see tornadoes in the United States, they're frequently in the southeast part of the country. And the reason is, as colder air covers much of the nation, that warm, unstable air that's one of the ingredients that we need for tornadoes is often most present along the Gulf Coast and the southeast U.S. So you combine that with a very strong upper-level storm system, and unfortunately, you had the ingredients in place that have led to the storms we've seen over the past 3 days.
So these headlines of unusual ice storms in places that wouldn't normally have them are just confirmation of this collision of warm air, cold air, and the kind of energy that stirs up these storms.
Yeah, absolutely. The primary ingredient for determining where and when storms occur has to do with that temperature gradient and temperatures across the country. And we've seen warm spells and cold spells. And when you combine that kind of thermal energy you have the breeding ground for storms producing all types of severe weather.
With the clear views that you can get out here on the plains, it's a different prediction setup than in a place like Georgia and Mississippi, where you've got very low visibility sometimes. And in this storm over the weekend, 20 tornadoes within the same storm system. How do you do a good job of prediction, and who needs to evacuate if there is a need for evacuation at all?
Well, you're certainly right about the challenges of spotting tornadoes, issuing warnings in the very short range as a storm is bearing down on a community. The combination in the southeast that we often see that proves so deadly, fast-moving storms, strong storms, and often overnight when people perhaps aren't watching television or paying attention to local warnings, you put those factors together and it really increases the vulnerability. I think one thing that's important is to stress before folks go to bed that tonight is a night that you might need to either be alert, make sure your weather radio is on, have someone monitoring the weather, and then have your plan rehearsed so that everyone in the family knows what they'll do when the warnings are issued and the storms are approaching. As fast as the storms are moving this weekend, if you waited until you saw it, it probably was too late to take action.
Now, given the kinds of preparations that you're describing, is that a new script for the people of the Southeast, that sort of go to bed with a plan B already in place?
We've actually been incorporating this into our outreach for actually a couple of decades, as far back as I can think. Now, we've had some tornado outbreaks in the Southeast. There was a Central Florida outbreak in February of 1998. Mobile, Alabama was hit on Christmas Day 2012. Many of these tornadoes occurred at night, some during the day. And so if you've lived in that part of the country for long, I think you've probably heard the importance of monitoring weather overnight, having a weather radio. Folks that are new to the area may not be as familiar with the fact that a lot of the severe storms occur overnight, and that's certainly something that has to be taken into consideration when you're preparing a severe weather safety plan for you and your family.
Talk about the low-level water saturated lowlands that sometimes these communities are in. Baton Rouge is one example. It's more associated with flooding last year than tornadoes, but does that add to the danger?
It certainly does. You know, typically the tornadoes will get the headlines because of the tremendous devastation they can cause. But actually, in terms of thunderstorm killers, flash flooding is the number one killer. And unfortunately, when you see tornado outbreaks, it often occurs with thunderstorms producing heavy rainfall. So really, we're not talking about just the tornado threat. There's tornadoes, there's damaging straight line winds, and of course, flash flooding. And the most common mistake people make is to try to drive through high water thinking that it's not deep enough to cause trouble. And they find out very quickly that only about a foot of water is enough if it's moving quickly to sweep a car off the road.
Speaking to us from just up the road in Norman, Oklahoma, Bill Bunting is the chief of forecast operations for the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
We want to remind you that over the course of the next 100 days, The Takeaway and our partner PRI will use the president's preferred method of communication to ask him 100 questions. And we want you to join us when it comes to healthcare, global security, immigration, foreign policy, education, domestic issues. What questions should President Trump have to answer? On Twitter, from Pear River, New York, do you have a plan for fixing Obamacare? Can you do it and drop mandatory child coverage for the childless? From Kinross, Michigan, I would ask him why he has such a troubled relationship with the truth. Listener in New York City wants to know why he won't release his tax returns.
My name is Mary, and I'm calling from Limerick, Pennsylvania. I would like to ask President Trump, is he pro-life, and is he going to put a conservative Supreme Court justice nominee forward? Because if he thought the Women's March on Saturday was big, it's only going to get worse.
You can tweet us your questions with the hashtag 100Days100Qs. That's 100Days100Qs. We'll wade through your suggestions and nominate one question each day that we think the president should answer. We hope you'll join us in tweeting each day's question, because more tweets are better than one, and each question will be tagged with 100Days100Qs. If you want answers, share your questions, and if you want to find out more about this project, just head over to thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. By LegalZoom, helping Americans with legal needs for over 15 years, including business formation and estate plans through a network of independent attorneys licensed in 48 states. More information at LegalZoom.com. And Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at FloridaTheFutureIsHere.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.